Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukeean Chip Duncan is known here and around the country for his documentary filmmaking. His company, Duncan Entertainment Group, produced a three-part series on the Reagan presidency that aired on PBS last year. He's also produced films on things like Afghanistan, Haiti, and the history of prayer in America. But Duncan is also an accomplished photographer, and a collection of his photography work from Peru and Kenya will be on display during tomorrow's gallery night activity in Milwaukee. Chip Duncan joins us in the studio to talk about this facet of his work. Nice to see you.
It's great. You have a great show.
You are a filmmaker, and by filmmaker, we generally mean moving pictures. Tell us about your interest in photography as well.
Well, about 2004, I started shooting stills for the first time. I had been a motion photographer for, gosh, about 25, 30 years at that point. And I started because I found myself going to a lot of remote and exotic places where I thought, you know, I might as well be doing stills as well. And it was 2004 when I went to Afghanistan for the first time and picked up a still camera. And the big revelation was I could shoot vertically.
Well, talk about the significance of that. There's a certain flexibility that might surprise people that comes with still photography versus filmmaking.
Well, in shooting motion, a lot of times you're sequencing shots. You're getting 7 or 8 or 10 shots of a particular activity and then sequencing them in an edit process for the film. In stills, it's one frame and everything has to be communicated in that individual frame. And then in addition, for me, shooting vertically was a whole new thing because I'd been confined by the box, the horizontal box, for over 30 years. And that may explain, ironically, may explain my emphasis on portraits. And I'm branching out more and more now. I'm shooting a lot more landscape than I was. But I think early on, I just had so much fun tilting the camera.
Well, and at the same time, it does put a lot of pressure on one single frame.
It does. And I think for me, the transition in some respects was fairly easy because I already understood light and composition. The big change with shooting portraits is you only have that one frame to tell the story. So what emotion are you trying to communicate? Early on, a lot of my still photography was based on shooting mostly Muslim people in Afghanistan, Sudan, Pakistan, East Africa. And a lot of times I was trying to use the camera to break down stereotypes. You know, images of people smiling, experiencing joy became very important to me. Now, interestingly, I'm shifting more because I've been doing so much documentation of slums in East Africa. And it's the images are really not designed to convey the emotional spectrum as much as the experience of poverty.
And you say you shoot still photos even while you're someplace to shoot a film. Is that right?
I do, yeah. I just am completing a short documentary called The Sound Man that we shot in the largely in the slums in Nairobi. But when I'm there, I'll hopefully always have time to do both. And one big change in the technology is that a lot of the new SLR cameras will allow both functions. So right now I'm using Canon cameras most of the time in the field, and it allows me to go back and forth very easily between stills and motion. So I still, as a motion photographer, I'll still be collecting the sequenced material I need for an edit. But as a still photographer, I can often branch off and just focus on stills.
In your experience, do people who are the subjects of your either photography or filmmaking, do they see – is there an appreciable difference between how they react to being captured for a still photograph versus part of a sequence of action?
Well, yes, I think there is. When I'm shooting stills, I'm always asking my subjects. I don't like the phrase take a picture because it implies that I'm taking something from them, and that's not my goal. I'm usually trying to capture their experience in an honest, truthful way. And so when I'm shooting stills, I've usually built an individual relationship. Sometimes it might only be for a couple of minutes, but I've asked. And so frequently, the images that I'm taking, they're looking directly into the camera. And so the experience for someone viewing the photograph is very different because there's eye contact. Where with motion, once I get into a sequence, let's say it's someone selling coffee in a market in Ethiopia or something, well, to sequence that, I have to get 7 or 8 shots, and usually they're not making eye contact. In fact, in television, it's almost like breaking the third wall. When someone makes eye contact on TV, it's very unusual, and there really better be a good reason for it, because it startles the viewer. Where with stills, it's quite the opposite. It invites you in and helps you, helps you experience whatever they're going through.
What is the significance of the photography that's represented in this current show?
This is different than other shows I've done. In one sense, the shows that I've done previous to this were in Berlin, Washington, D.C., New York City, and they've all been focused on portraits. This one includes landscapes, so that's different. And then in addition, we're calling the show Time After Time, and in part that's because these two countries, Kenya and Peru, are two that I visit frequently, usually annually. And so they're places that I know well and have navigated for many, many years.
Well, what is it about those two countries in particular that keeps you coming back to them?
Well, the first trip I did to Peru was in the mid-90s. I was producing a series with Susan Templin from our staff, and the series was called Mystic Land. So I went there largely to cover Machu Picchu and the Sacred Valley, and really, really fell in love with it. So in the case of Peru, it inspired what has now become an annual journey where I guide people on through the Sacred Valley and to Machu Picchu. And so it's become more of a guiding experience that I use for photography. So in the case of Peru, it's pure pleasure and joy. In the case of Nairobi, and Kenya in general, Nairobi is the access point to East Africa. So I've gone through it many times to get to other places. And I have built a significant relationship with a company there called CameraPix, and their founder, Salim Amin, has become a close friend. So the more work, frankly, that the Duncan Group can do with CameraPix, the better.
Going back to Peru for a moment, you talk about the sheer joy, and it's clearly represented. There's a wonderful picture of actually a double rainbow that's included as part of this show, and much different than your portrait work.
Yeah, I've gotten to know these sacred places. Pizac is the place you're referring to, but Ollantaytambo, Machu Picchu, Sacsayhuaman, many of these locations I've gotten to know well. So by virtue of visiting them with some frequency, I usually have scouted the best camera positions. And the image you're referring to in Pizac with the double rainbow, of the roughly 12, 13 times I've been there, this was the only time that I managed to capture a rainbow. I usually go in late November, early December, and that is the start of the rainy season. And I target that period largely because the rainbows in the Andes at that time are extraordinary.
At the same time, you know, you're capturing images that don't necessarily speak to the idea of joy. There's a certain caring clearly that goes into the people that are represented, but you know, for example, you have the wobbly toddler, and we can't really see what her expression is.
Well, the image called the wobbly toddler, she's clearly from a poor household. I mean, she's living in some kind of poverty, but that's true. The poverty experience is true largely throughout most of Peru. The Sacred Valley is actually one of the more affluent parts of Peru now because of tourism. And it's also the experience that I'm spending the most time documenting in Kenya as well. And so whether it's the slums of Lima, where I've spent a fair amount of time, or the slums of Kenya, the experience of poverty, I think, is largely misunderstood, especially global poverty here in the U.S. And you can put words to it. In fact, the book I have coming out next year does that. But I think a lot of times the pictures convey it more when you see a child who's wearing shoes that are too small or too large or mismatched, oftentimes just made out of recycled, you know, tires, and clothing that is clearly, you know, seen its better days. You know, you start to understand what poverty looks like. And in addition, in both places, Peru and Kenya, there's an extraordinary love of colorful fabric. So even in the poorest populations, you'll still see a real strong desire to experience beauty, and clothing oftentimes is a way to reflect that.
Well, and that contrast is also at work in the pictures of the slums in Nairobi. There are a couple I'm thinking of. And what's, I think, particularly interesting is, again, this contrast between color and, you know, sort of heartbreaking misery.
I will say that the misery index, for lack of a better term, in Nairobi in particular is really quite staggering. Kenya, unlike Ethiopia, for example, Kenya has a really significant income disparity. Ethiopia, for better or worse, is almost entirely poor, like similar to Haiti. But in Kenya, there's a lot of disparity, and the slums in Nairobi are some of the worst in the world. I've spent a lot of time in the Kibera slum, and it's a place of great paradox because on the one hand, no one there is making very much money, usually under $2 a day. The population density is probably the highest of any place on earth today. Estimates in a roughly 380-acre landscape, there's approximately 1 million to 1.2 million people. So, you know, we're talking half the size of Lapham Peak State Park with, you know, an unbelievable amount of people packed in. And at the same time, Kibera slum is relatively hopeful in that a lot of people are employed and making some kind of living. So their children, I think, in many cases will have a better lifestyle. By contrast, the Mathari slum in Nairobi is truly the most desperate place I've ever worked and quite dangerous as well.
You go back to these places time and time again. Are you seeing any kind of evolution to the experience in the slums of Kenya?
Well, in evolution in terms of their experience,
yeah.
I would say in Kibera, yeah. I think Kibera slum in Nairobi has gotten a lot of attention. People may remember it from a movie called The Constant Gardener with Ralph Fiennes. And it's very cinematic in many ways. And so it's been more heavily exposed. And they're starting to work on a lot of solutions for that particular slum. And being able to have pure water at an affordable price is a big one. But the schools are also dramatically improved throughout Kenya and in Kibera in particular. So Kibera, I think, has a lot of hope and a lot of joy in many ways.
What would you hope that people who have a chance to see the images that are on display Friday and Saturday, what would you hope they'll be talking about as they leave?
I hope that they come away with a broader view of just what it's like to live on this planet. Most people that I experience wherever I go are quick with a smile and incredibly friendly. The things that divide us are portrayed on news all the time. And yet I think what we've tried to do, and certainly with the people who've put this show together, Susan Templin and Theron Pfeiffer, I think we're trying to get across the message that we are more similar than we are different. And that there's a way to find beauty in even the most difficult places on Earth.
Chip Duncan, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Filmmaker, writer, and photographer Chip Duncan is president of the Duncan Entertainment Group, which produces documentaries seen around the world. The exhibit of his photographs, called Time After Time, is tomorrow evening during gallery night and Saturday afternoon and evening at 777 North Jefferson Street. There's a slideshow of the photographs we talked about at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. A Milwaukee rock musician curates a show reinterpreting the music of a legendary American songwriter. We'll hear about that show when Lake Effect returns on listener-supported Milwaukee Public Radio.
Turn after turn, if you're lost, you